Case number 12-7127, Theodore Westby et al. Versus District of Columbia et al. Appellants, Edwin Espinoza, Officer, Metropolitan Police Department, in both his official and individual capacities et al. Mr. Schifferle for the appellants, Mr. Latimer for the appellate.
Mr. Schifferle.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Carl Schifferle for the District of Columbia and Officers Parker and Campanelli. The District Court erred in granting summary judgment against the defendants for several reasons. First, the case law shows that there was probable cause for the arrest. Second, the defendants are entitled to qualified immunity and common law privilege because, at the very least, the law was not clearly established that there was no probable cause. Third, Officers Parker and Campanelli are not personally responsible for all of the plaintiff's arrests, since their mere involvement in the underlying investigation does not suffice. And then fourth, even assuming that the defendants themselves are not entitled to summary judgment for the three reasons I've just given, a jury would have to decide the plaintiff's claims. There was probable cause to arrest for unlawful entry. As this court held in Thomas, a prima facie case of unlawful entry is established when, quote, an individual, quote, entered a building not his own, which was obviously closed to the general public. That is the facts in this case. In addition, we have the fact that the homeowner told the police that these individuals were not authorized to be there, that their entry was against his will. The fact that the plaintiffs or a individual on the scene told police that we received an invitation to come at most establishes a defense that can be raised at a criminal trial. And that's, again, the Thomas case that we cited, quote, that a person believed he had a right to be in such a building is a matter for the defense, unquote. Such defenses.
But that's not in the nature of an affirmative defense. That's in the nature of a defense that an element isn't established, isn't it?
No, Your Honor. As the D.C. Court of Appeals cases have explained, and we cited in our brief, that a defendant would be entitled to this reasonable good faith belief instruction if the evidence supported it. And where the evidence did not support such an instruction should not be given. So it is in the nature of a defense. In any event, the police officers on the scene are not required to resolve that themselves. That is an issue for the trial, regardless of whether it's, however it might be phrased as a defense or as some other matters. It is an issue for the trial.
Other than the homeowner's discussion with the police officer, what is the evidence that the individuals were not invited or permitted to be in the premises?
The evidence that the individuals were not permitted to be there was the homeowner's statement that the individuals were not permitted to be there.
Is there any evidence that the individuals, that the plaintiffs were aware of that?
There is, first of all, I think no requirement that the police officers have to credit the suspect's story. So simply because they're told by an individual on the scene that we were invited, the police aren't obligated to credit that statement of the suspect. But there is additional, and that's the Kozlowska case, for example, that we cited in our brief from the D.C. Court of Appeals. There it upheld a conviction, even though for unlawful entry, even though there was unrebutted trial testimony that the building superintendent had invited that individual into the building. There is also additional evidence in this case, Your Honor, which would dispel any, we think, reasonable belief in the plaintiff's right to be there. There is the consciousness of guilt. As we discussed in our brief, that when the police entered, the individuals inside scattered and hid. There were false and conflicting
I'm not sure I'm understanding. What are you doing with the Ortberg test, knew or should have known? That's the test.
Ortberg was a case that was recently decided after the briefs in this case. It is the first case in the D.C. Court of Appeals or any binding precedent indicating that that is an element.
That's the test. That's the D.C. Court of Appeals test. It doesn't matter that it's after your brief. That's the way they've described their law. Ignoring it?
No, Your Honor. I mean, it does. The fact that
under
it was
that test, you lose.
No, Your Honor.
That's what the district court is essentially finding. Yes, you haven't. I've been waiting for you. You've gone 5, 6, 7 minutes. You haven't addressed the critical test. That's the test. Newer should have known, and I don't know how the district court is wrong if you apply newer should have known.
Well, first of all, Your Honor, that decision, the Ortberg decision, rose in 2013. For purposes of qualified immunity, at the very least.
Not if they say they're summarizing the pre-existing law, and all they're doing is confirming it, and if you look back at the pre-existing law, it looks like that's all it is.
No, Your Honor, I disagree with that. The Ortberg decision did not say it was...
They certainly don't suggest, as Judge Pillard has said, nor does the prior law suggest anything about this an affirmative defense. That's just not the law. That's your creation.
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, I quoted from Thomas. The Ortberg decision did say the law had been unclear. It did say, and I believe for the first time, that it was holding this new should have known was an element for the very first time in 2013. So for purposes of qualified immunity, at the very least, the officers can't be held responsible for that. I would also say all the facts that I'm citing that dispel this reasonable good faith belief in the plaintiff's right to enter likewise demonstrates that the plaintiffs knew or should have known they were not authorized to be there. They scattered and hid when police arrived. They gave false and conflicting explanations for their presence. Some said it was a bachelor party, but they couldn't identify the bachelor. Others, a birthday party. The alleged invitor was only known by a nickname or just a first name, Peaches. No last name was known. When the police contacted her, she refused to return to the house, saying that she would be arrested.
I'm not clear where you're placing the burden. Isn't it the circumstances have to make clear that there was some restriction on entry, because there's a state of mind requirement for the unlawful entry, and that goes back. I mean, Ortberg, I think, does accurately state the law, but it's consistent with the prior precedents that show that the circumstances have to make clear that there was some restriction on entry. Don't go into a boarded up vacant house, a restricted event in a hotel, an area that's reserved for ticketed passengers or the train station. Don't go to these places without permission. And so I guess I'm unclear. You seem to be putting the burden on the plaintiffs, but wasn't the burden on the officers to conclude that these people went into the premises notwithstanding some restriction on entry?
Well, Your Honor, all the police officers have to have is a reasonable belief in guilt. They don't have to show conclusively that the plaintiffs committed the crime. They don't have to credit the plaintiff's story, particularly in light of all the evidence that we have here. I would also add there was evidence of illegal activities going on in the house, that the house was vacant. There was essentially
no
furniture.
I'm aware of all those aspects of the legal standard. I just wanted you to focus in on what was it that on which the officers reasonably could have concluded that these people were in a place that they knew or should have known they were not permitted to be, that the individuals who were there knew or should have known that they were not permitted to be there. What's the evidence of that, that the, on which the officers relied at the time?
Well, that's all of the evidence I've just been discussing, Your Honor. It's what a reasonable police officer could have believed. It's an objective test. And these are all the facts that I've been going through, consciousness of guilt, illegal activities, the fact the property was vacant. It simply can't be consistent with the legislative intent that when a homeowner finds unauthorized strangers in his or her house, the police can't even make an arrest if that individual simply says, I was invited. That can't be the legislative intent. I would also say with respect to qualified immunity and common law privilege, let's look at the case law. The district court did not cite a single case where the D.C. Court of Appeals or any binding precedent found that an arrest for unlawful entry was without probable cause. Every case that the district court relied upon, the deciding court found that there was probable cause or sufficient evidence for unlawful entry. So that clearly shows the law was not clearly established, that there was no probable cause. All the cases we cited, I talked about the Kozlowski case, the Castorena case, the Tillman case, Thomas, which I mentioned, the McMoyen case, the Culp case, all these cases would indicate to a reasonable police officer that there was probable cause for an arrest in this case.
You're just talking about results in cases, not the principles enunciated. You don't win because most of the cases you can find went your way. You have to win based on the principles enunciated in the cases.
Well, but also the underlying facts, Your Honor. It has to be factually similar case where probable cause was not found. That's what qualified immunity requires. I see I'm out of time. But
I'm just trying to understand how, for example, in Kozlowska, the person who was found to have unlawfully entered had received a barring notice. She had been told, you can't go in there. She had received a legal notice. So what I'm trying to understand is, in your view, what is the analogous fact in this case, other than that people who were scantily clad ran away? I mean, if officers come in, a lot of people might not want to, come forward.
Right. Well, inferences can be drawn different ways. The question is, was this a reasonable inference that a reasonable police officer could have drawn? And the answer, we believe, is certainly yes. I would also note for officers Parker and Campanelli, they reasonably relied upon a supervisor's directive, which is further grounds for qualified immunity.
I see them in the watch commander said it didn't make any sense.
Right, but the officers Parker and Campanelli, I mean, that's something that occurred subsequently. The question is, did they reasonably rely upon the directive that they received at the time from Sergeant Suber? And as this court in Elkins said, that can't support a qualified immunity defense, and that meets the facts on this particular case. I do see I'm into my rebuttal time, and I did wish to save some. If the court has no further questions, thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Gregory Latimer on behalf of the appellees. The district court, did a complete analysis of all of the issues in this case, and there were, as it noted, 6 rounds of briefing. And even though the defendants were provided with 6 rounds of briefing, they still couldn't come forward with any evidence to support any of these arrests. I mean, Campanelli and Parker testified clearly that the only reason that they arrested these people for unlawful entry was because the sergeant told them to. The sergeant testified that the reason that he believed there was a basis for unlawful entry was because you have an obligation to find out if you lawfully can be on in a residence. And that really just makes no sense. It's inconsistent with the law. And I strenuously disagree with the appellants regarding Ortberg. I mean, Ortberg did not establish new law. What Ortberg did was clarify the existing law. And in that case, the D.C. Court of Appeals indicated that the jury instruction that was applicable fully sets forth the elements, and those elements include the fact that the people who were there knew or should have known that they did not have the right to be there. And as we talk about the owner, I mean, we can call it the owner, but the police officers testified that they didn't know who the person was. All that person did was say that they were the owner, and that the people didn't give the people permission to be there. But there was no testimony at all of any kind, nor was there any suggestion that any of those people did not have a reasonable belief that they should have been there. I mean, this was a group arrest, and there just was no probable cause. And then they made a determination that there was no probable cause, and then they decided to arrest them for disorderly conduct.
Excuse me, Mr. Latimer, can you address the negligent supervision element? What are you basing that on?
Two things. And I think that Tulin is instructive on that, and that is the D.C. Court of Appeals where the supervisor here clearly ordered the arrest. And in Tulin, the D.C. Court of Appeals said that a supervisor has an obligation to know the law. This sergeant clearly did not know the law. So that's one aspect of it. And then you go to the second aspect of it. Even when they got to the police station and the lieutenant made a decision that the arrest for unlawful entry had no legal basis, they then turn around and arrest the people for disorderly conduct. And every officer who testified that they never observed anybody engaged in any illegal conduct. There was nothing about this case that would support an arrest for disorderly conduct. And in fact, Sergeant Suber had a conversation with the lieutenant Never, where he told him no basis for that existed. And as he said in his deposition, in response to him telling him that there was no basis, he said, I'm the watch commander. And the Attorney General's office told us to arrest him for loud voices. Clearly, there was no basis for disorderly conduct, the appellant contends, well, we could have arrested them for disorderly conduct because there was loud noise. Well, first of all, that is not a position that they offered below. And secondly, nobody in this case talked about who, if anyone, was engaged in activity that would be considered disorderly. Nobody was accused of acting out, talking loudly, being boisterous. Nobody in this case was identified as a person that would have been responsible for or could have been charged with disorderly. And so they make this new argument on appeal.
That was addressed by the trial court.
The loud voices, because that's what was said. The court said that there was, you could have arrested them for loud voices. But the officers did not testify that they heard that. No officer testified to that. Even though there could be another basis that you could justify the arrest upon, if those facts were present, I'm not suggesting that the court is limited to looking at probable cause based upon simply what the officer said, and it cannot look to see if the record contains evidence from which a reasonable officer could have concluded.
I'm sorry, I don't want to get too deep into the evidence, but doesn't Campanelli say we heard a lot of loud music when he came up?
He says that he heard loud music, but he doesn't say who the loud music was coming from. He says that he heard it, but nobody else heard it. He says when we came up, we heard loud music. But I don't think that that's the standard. I think that just because you hear something loud, there must be a disturbance of the peace. There must be somebody who was disturbed by the loud noise.
Yeah, when you come up outside a house and the music is thumping out onto the street and a neighbor's called and complained, Officer Jarbo told him neighbors had complained, and he comes up and he says, we heard loud music, what more is needed?
Well, I think that in the context of a disorderly, which is a misdemeanor, which is something that the officers must observe. I mean, if you're going to say that there was loud music and you don't know who the loud music was coming from, I think that presents a problem. I mean, this is a group arrest. You're not saying that everybody, they're not saying that everybody was engaged in loud noises. And in this case, there's nothing to suggest that they were acting as a unit, that all of these people were involved. There was no evidence that, in fact, when the officers went in, there was testimony that some people were upstairs, some people were in the kitchen, some people were in the living room. They don't know when people got there. The testimony in this case was that some people had arrived within 10 minutes of the officers, some people had arrived within an hour, some people. So when you talk about that and you have a group arrest, that I don't believe would be proper or appropriate under those circumstances, especially when you're not identifying who it is you're claiming was engaged in this conduct. But I don't believe that that rises to the level of disorderly in the first place, simply because you hear loud noise or music playing loudly when you come upon a scene. I don't think there's any decisions of the D.C. Superior Court that support the position that that would be a basis for an arrest, especially of everybody in the house for disorderly conduct.
Going back to this question of probable cause for the unlawful entry, are you arguing that the police have to credit the response that people give when they say they were invited?
No. What I'm saying is that there must be some evidence that these people knew or should have known that they did not have a right to be there. I mean, the government wants to say that, well, this house was abandoned. Well, there was nothing abandoned about the house because the testimony was, number one, the lights were on in the house. There was furniture in the house. Ms. Chittum testified there was food in the refrigerator. She had been to the house on a previous occasion. So did Ms. Sanjay Hunt. They had been to the house on other occasions. They had a key. There was no evidence of a forced entry. And in fact, the affidavit that they submitted from Mr. Keck indicated that months before he thought the house was vacant, but in recent weeks he had seen a number of cars parked outside of the house. He had seen people coming and going. So there was nothing about this situation. The people indicated they had been invited there. There's no question that somebody told them to be there. That's not a disputed fact. What they say is the person who invited them there did not have the right to invite them there. That's far different than the people not having a understanding that they had a right to be there. So the element is that the information that the police possessed at the time was that these people were here at the invitation of another person, but maybe that person didn't have the right.
But they also had information that someone who purported to be the owner of the house had not given permission. They had both of them. They had information of both.
That's true, but they had no information that the people who were there had any reason to believe that they did not, that the owner did not want them there. There was nothing that would suggest that they had knowledge of that, or they should have known that. There was nothing about that property that suggests that the person who has the keys, the person who allowed us into the house, doesn't have the authority to allow us into the house. I mean, this could have been easily resolved. You just tell the people to leave. I mean, you come in, there's the dispute that, if there's a dispute, if there's a legitimate dispute about whether you should or you shouldn't be there, you just tell them to leave. You don't arrest them. You don't arrest everybody because you're not sure of what's going on.
Well, but the question here is whether the police have probable cause, right? Can they? And so my question is, can they look at everything that's going on?
They have to look at the element.
It seems to me that the district court here looked at this question of whether there had been an express notice that they weren't supposed to be there. But the police have actually more than that to consider, right? They have what the neighbors have said about the house, that they think it was abandoned. They have the response that the people give when they come and try to talk to them, including people hiding from the police. Maybe that's normal, maybe not. But they're looking at all of those things. So do, and we're not saying, this is not whether or not you could prove the case. It's only the question of whether that's enough for probable cause.
Well, first of all, we have to take the facts a little bit differently and look at them as what they were. These people, when you're talking about they hid from the police knocked the door down. The police come in and they knock the door and they bang on the door and people scatter about. Nobody's hiding from the police. I mean, this was not a situation where people are running. They found no evidence of any criminal activity in this house. None. Zip. Nobody had drugs. Nobody had weapons. There was nothing of that sort. And then secondly, as I said, this is not a situation about the police having information that would lead a reasonable person to believe that they had engaged in this conduct, because in order to make the claim, you have to have a reasonable basis to believe that all of the elements of the crime exist. And in this case, one of those elements, at least, that these people knew or should have known that they had no right to be there, was absent. That is clear.
Mr. Lauren, what's your best case pre-Ortberg on the knew or should have known that they had no right to be there element?
I think that all of the cases point to that, because when in Ortberg, all the court did was explain exactly what had gone down, and what they had said in other cases was that in the absence of evidence, such as a posting or the indication of boarding up or something of that nature, then you have to have something else, and there must be a reason, and they go into the bona fide belief that you have a right to be there. But all of the case law, I mean, Kozlowski isn't contrary to this. Kozlowski involved the barring of it.
Kozlowski isn't, but there's another case, and I don't remember the name of it right now, but the one where the house was vacant, I suppose abandoned, and there was an argument that sometimes it was boarded up, sometimes it wasn't.
Right.
That the person who came into it probably entered through the back, which was not boarded up, which had an open door, and so forth.
This is far different than that. This house wasn't boarded up. In fact, the person had a key. The lights were on. There was a bed. There was food in the refrigerator. This is far different from that. This house was never boarded up. This house, nobody went in through the back door. Everybody came in through the front. The people were invited. They were let in. In fact, Mr. Taylor testified that he saw the person that he believed was the owner of the house leaving as he came in, and he went through the front door. So there was nothing about this situation that would have led anybody to believe that they didn't have a right to be there. And so that's what distinguishes this from any of those other cases. And as I said, the point is that there was no probable cause. But again, you go to the point that they went to the station, they determined that, and then they rearrest them on the basis of disorderly conduct.
Do you think that they're actually rearrested?
Yes.
Do you see this as two separate arrests?
It was, and they said it was. And Sergeant Suva said that we were told to let them go. And there was testimony from the individuals that they were told they were going to be released. They were unhandcuffed, and then they were rehandcuffed and charged with disorderly conduct. So, yes, there was. In technical terms, because the police had decided that the unlawful entry wasn't a valid claim, they were told to let them go. They were told that they were going to be let go, and then they were rearrested again. And while they want to characterize that as prosecutorial discretion, that was nothing of the kind. This was a police department that had gone out and made a mass arrest in order to make a splash, and they arrested everybody. And then they realized that when they arrested all of these people, no basis existed for that arrest. And then they tried to justify it with a disorderly conduct arrest, which had even less basis. I'm sorry, Judge, you have a question? Yeah, my time is up. Unless there are any other questions, I'll thank you for your time.
Counsel has no time left. We will give you 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. First of all, as long as there is probable cause for any offense, the arrest is lawful. Mr. Latter never argued in the briefs that there were two separate arrests, and in fact, that's inconsistent with how the trial on damages went. Mr. Latter mentioned a lot of facts. Some of those are not part of what the police knew at the time, so that's irrelevant. Some of the facts that he mentioned aren't actually true. He said there was no evidence of criminal activity. The officers testified that they smelled marijuana, for example. I would also point out what the officers did in order to try to investigate the plaintiff's claim that they were invited. They spoke to Peaches. She refused to return to the house because she said she would be arrested. She was evasive. She repeatedly hung up the phone on police and then eventually admitted that she had lied when she first said that they had permission. She admitted to the police that, no, we didn't have permission to be in the house.
It's interesting the way you say that. She lied that they had permission. She acknowledged that she invited them, but then she said she lied that she had the authority to do so, which really seems to corroborate the plaintiff's claim. If she admitted, I did tell them, come have a party, I sort of had been planning to rent this place, but actually, no, I didn't, and I don't have any lawful authority. She admits that, but I thought the record was pretty clear that she admitted that she had invited them.
Yeah, but the police obviously don't have to credit that. Knowing that she's lied to them before, they don't have to credit other things that she says. And obviously, it impeaches the whole story because the plaintiffs are relying on Peaches, who is obviously not credible. That casts doubt on the entire story. In terms of qualified immunity, that's another important point, because even assuming there was no probable cause, a reasonable police officer in these officers' positions and the facts of this particular case could have believed that the arrests were lawful. I think Mr. Latimer, his answer to the question about pre-Ortenberg case law, it's pretty clear that never before Ortenberg.
In Smith versus the United States, the 1971 case.
Yes, Your Honor, that describes.
A person enters a place with a good purpose and with a bona fide belief in his right to enter, he lacks the element of criminal intent required and is not guilty of unlawful entry. That's all Ortenberg was referring.
Respectfully, no, Your Honor. If you read the Ortenberg decision, it does say that the law before had been unclear, less than precise, and it gave its...
I just thought it was unprecise to me, Smith.
Okay, well...
pretty clear to me.
Well, Ortberg, respectfully, Your Honor, did say that the law had been unclear.
You want to take Ortberg off the table. Okay, I'll take it off the table, and we'll use Smith, which is 1971, many, many years ago.
Yes, Your Honor. Well, I think Smith...
You can't have it both ways.
I believe Smith also describes it as a defense, and certainly Thomas describes it as a defense from this court, citing the Whittlesey case, which also describes it as a defense. In either way, the law has to be clearly established in order to deny the defendant's qualified immunity.
That's an element of intent required. It's not a defense.
Well,
it's a defense in terms of failure to prove. What Ortberg says is the existence of a reasonable good faith belief is a valid defense precisely because it precludes the government from proving what it must. That the defendant knew or should have known that his entry was against the will of the lawful occupant, which is why my first question to you was whether you were characterizing it as an affirmative defense, which I don't think it is. It's a defense in the sense of being able to knock out an element of what the government actually has to prove and what the officers must know.
And I would point to the McGloin case, which is the case I didn't remember the name of earlier, and that talks about where this reasonable bona fide belief is a jury instruction that the defense can request if the evidence supports it. And if the evidence doesn't support it, the defense doesn't get that instruction. And that is what happened in the McGloin case. So at the very least, the law was unclear, and that entitles the defendants to qualified immunity. And, Your Honor, I believe it was the Culp case which you were talking about before in terms of the vacant building, and that is further case law supporting a reasonable belief that these arrests were lawful, and I'm probably out of time. So unless there are further questions, I appreciate the Court's attention.
Thank you.